Before we go on to the fifth of the seven points, is there any questions about the five powers, either in daily life or at the time of death?
It's not so much a question, more something I have to get off my chest. Like, for myself, I really would love to go this way. If my time comes, I would love to be prepared like this. But
sure.
In real life, I mean, I'm not talking about violent deaths or accidents or something, but especially those people in hospital who died, their cancer patients, that incredibly pains because their tumors taking place, displacing organs, stuff, it's horrible. And so we gave them morphine, like shitloads of morphine, not a little bit, but we completely zonked them off. How, and my personal fear never was death, but what comes before death is this kind of suffering, like physical suffering. How to go there, especially with the pain before.
Sure. I mean, of course, if the person has been trying to follow some path, even remotely like this, in terms of trying to not react to pleasant and unpleasant things with attachment and aversion and trying to be more mindful, then at least hopefully that person may not be having so much aversion to their suffering, physical suffering. At least they can maybe practice a little bit of acceptance, you know, that yes, okay, I've got this and it's painful, okay, but, you know, not to have the aversion. So I think at whatever level we can get people to practice that sort of acceptance, that could help them at least not magnify the amount of suffering they experience. Of course, if they really are following some sort of spiritual path in terms of loving kindness and compassion, on top of that, then, you know, they using these sort of method by me willingly accepting my pain here, may all others who have pain be free of their pain. You know, if they can manage that sort of state of mind, of course that's not going to be the average person, but if someone has sort of this approach in their life, then they could use that to also not have aversion to their heavy suffering, and then maybe use that as a meaningful thing to help others to develop loving kindness and compassion. And in that way, at least their mind won't be so agitated and disturbed by the physical discomfort they're feeling. Of course, I think that if they're not any, I mean, of course, you know, we hear about people who are high level practitioners and they have this sort of situation. They often refuse morphine and things like that because they want to maintain an alert mind even though there is a lot of physical discomfort. And like one concrete example about that is some years ago there was a great master down here, point's gone blank now. Anyway, the top pitcher, Curtis Enchu Rinpoche. He was, some years ago, he was actually teaching in Israel and he had some stomach problems. And so he went to the hospital in Israel and they diagnosed advanced stomach cancer. And according to the doctors, he should have been in extreme pain. They wanted to give him morphine because from what they saw, anyone in that state must be in excruciating pain. But he told them through the translator, I have no pain, no suffering. Of course, he has a lot of sensations and that's probably why he went to the doctor. Maybe he had some digestive problems. He had a lot of sensations, but he said, I have no pain, no pain at all. And so for someone at that level, that is simply intense sensations. But of course, that's a high level of practitioner. So those sort of people don't need the painkiller because they're not suffering. Yes, it's massive sensations, but it's not overwhelming them. So of course, we can at our level start to move in that direction in terms of little discomforts, not having aversion to it, trying to practice acceptance as much as we can. And then on top of that, if we can implement some of these ideas about, you know, if we have a situation where we can't remedy it, then to use this practice of willingly accepting it and using the Tonglen approach. And in that way, often then that positive state of mind of loving compassion also helps to reduce the amount of discomfort we feel. But I think a person who's in you're saying in this state, if they have not even the basics of those abilities, then yes, perhaps they need to, you need to give them some heavy medication to reduce the amount of suffering they experience. And then as best we can is to try to use some of these ideas, but in a very simple way, in terms of helping them to transition through the death process. And within Buddhism, you know, you see now a lot of these hospices where they have people go to they have terminal illness or so forth to enable them to go through a very good transition, rather than maybe being in a hospital, you know, full of tubes and this sort of sterile environment and not so very supportive environment, to be able to go through this. And there are, I think, a number of practices sort of based on these ideas, but in a very simple way for people who are not even Buddhist, that they can at least make that transition less fearful, anxious and painful and suffering through similar ideas in terms of acceptance and letting go of attachment. And so I think there you'll find in those hospice movements, they have a lot of very good practices and techniques based on this, but even for people who are not really Buddhist, and in implementing those, I think could be helpful. So, you know, you've got the whole range of possibilities. But, I mean, again, if someone is in that situation you described, then yes, it's very difficult, particularly if they've not previously had developed any sort of mindfulness, or if they're completely reacting, then at least what we can try to do is to get them past the sort of the denial stage and get them to the acceptance stage. And at least then they maybe won't have so much aversion and not magnify the amount of suffering they experience. I mean, it's very difficult, of course. I mean, of course, the thing to do is we need, as Alan Moyle said, you know, you need to prepare for this. It's no use thinking, okay, I'm going to use this when I approach death, and then do no preparation. Yeah. Then, of course, it's not going to happen. Yeah. So, of course, you know, if we begin to do these practices now in daily life, then as we're approaching death, when we have some familiarity with this, then we can implement them. But, you know, we need to prepare. That's the one here at the beginning of this section that said, where was it? Or maybe at the end. Where was it? Oh, yeah, on the top of page 114, it says, practices such as Tantra cannot be practiced at this juncture. And that is the practice of Poa. Again, if we're not trained in that technique, I mean, highly trained, then as it says here, it's not going to help. It's not, I think that technique to try to implement that with someone who doesn't have the training, I think, as said here, is not going to be very helpful. Rather, this approach would be more helpful. Of course, if we have training in that, we've done a lot of training in that, then maybe that could be of some use to ourselves at that time. But if someone else, we're trying to guide them through that process, and they don't have that training, then at that time to try to introduce them to this idea, I think, is not going to be helpful. Yeah. Of course, if we have that level of practice, then that can be helpful. But to really use that level of practice at death is not easy. Sure, I know. And we find many high-level tantric practices being taught to beginners these days, unfortunately. And what I see is that, of course, they have their time and place and they can be very beneficial. But if we don't have the foundation for them, we can put a lot of effort into these practices and not really receive much benefit. In fact, sometimes these sorts of practices without the foundation can just increase the self-grasping, self-cherishing because of the nature of the practice. So, you know, we need to be a little bit, to do these practices in a proper way with a good foundation. So I think anyone who's teaching that responsibly would, you know, if they're teaching it in a more public sphere, would hopefully at the beginning say, to effectively practice this, you need this, this, and this, and this. So at least people are aware of that. Otherwise, it's not very helpful, I think.
His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, when he has explained the process of death and reincarnation, he says that some bodily marks are seen in the next birth. When somebody is leaving the body, then why should a bodily mark appear from one body to the other?
Possibly because that had an effect on the mind, which left an imprint in the mind, which ripened in that way. Of course, we're not saying that the mark has been transferred at the physical level throughout, but what the connection is, how that works, I've never seen an explanation on it. I guess there's a mental aspect to that somehow. How that works, I don't know. I've never read.
Mm-hmm. Then you have mentioned, you know, within the Bardo, you know, there's some aspects of, you know, being aware of others, but upset of nobody responds to somebody.
Oh, that was in the case when the person wasn't aware that they're dead yet.
Yeah, but is there a kind, you know, within the Bardo, is there a kind of a sense of I?
Of course, yes.
It comes back after the clear light?
Yes.
Then it comes yes. back, and what?
That sense of I, of,
based on, is it
the subtle body and subtle mind.
Yeah, but just, you know, is it related to a memory or, you know, some imprint of, you know, the last idea of identity? And, you know, then also the question, to whom do they want to communicate to, where they feel there is no response? Is there a selection? Because there are billion streams of consciousness. And also, you know, is it related also to a certain time? You know, you might, you know, in a certain state, you know, you might you know, try to communicate to some, identity which has already, you know, transferred. Maybe, you know, your mother, which has now, you know, reincarnated or as your neighbor, but you still are communicating with some stream of consciousness at a certain time frame which has already passed. Is this possible?
So what's the question in all of that? Can you sort of condense it? There's about six questions there, I think. I'll try and answer a couple of them. In the Bardo state, of course, we have a subtle body, subtle mind, so there is a sense of I. And this, because it's a subtle mind that's active, it has a lot of ability that we don't at the coarse level mind have, which means the subtle mind, that Bardo being, can see human beings and other beings. And again, the sense of identity, like every life, is based on the body and the mind and our past memories. And I think the Bardo being can tap into the past memories of the just ended life and maybe even earlier lives. They're still there. So then they could, like Alan Wallace said, not realize they're dead yet because they're identifying with those memories. And that's why they have this confusion that no one's communicating with them. And then eventually they'll understand they've died and then they'll identify with this body and mind they have. Oh yes, I'm in the intermediate state. And of course that sense of I is not a sense of a human I. They're not human at that stage because they're a subtle body, subtle mind. And they can connect with, because of the capacity of the mind, they can connect and see all these beings, and particularly they can remember these people that they were connected with in the past life, and they may try to communicate with them. All of these things are possible.
But it's so strange, you know, how to make the selection, because you are...
Which selection?
Yeah, you have so many different identities.
Which selection? Selecting the rebirth or selecting...
You know, millions of possibilities
Because you have all the memories, and so you remember these people who you were just associated with maybe 30 minutes ago or a day ago. Well, because that's your memories. You remember these people, and you know that you were connected with these people just now. And you probably would be maybe in the same physical location still.
Yeah, but you might be in India and maybe your relatives are in another country.
And then you can go there and see them.
So you choose those who you have been connected with at the time of death?
I don't know. If people are strongly attached to them, they may want to communicate with them. If they're not, they may not. Then it's debatable whether you have the ability to know where your mother has gone, even as an intermediate being. That would be debatable if they could know that.
Yeah, but could you communicate on the stream of consciousness of your mother at a certain other time, so that there's no order of time?
No. Because Bardo being is within time and space. You mean like in the Bardo being would talk to the mother that from 10 years ago?
Yeah.
No, the mother doesn't exist 10 years ago. The Bardo being could remember, have memories of that, but it wouldn't be able to communicate with the mother.
But the stream of consciousness of the mother, who is now maybe another
being, right.
Is existing and
as this new being at that time, yes.
Yeah, but if you go back
isn't
there?
No, there is time. There is time, yeah. I mean, also the Bardo being is within the time and space, just like us. They may be able to have memories and remember past things that we can't, but that's it.
Just think like this, if the Bardo being could go back in time to see his former mother, you could also go back in time to see your former mind screen, so you could communicate yourself with the...
I'm just wondering, or is it like a magnet? You know, like a magnet that just becomes attracted to your elements of different habits.
Yeah, I mean, generally it's said, you know, like you said, the Bardo being's programmed in terms of the next birth. But part of that programming, of course, is all the actions that we've done in our previous life. So it's often said that if we have a strong connection with certain people or certain place, then the Bardo being would gravitate towards that to try to find suitable conditions there. So often then you would find that the person, if suitable conditions allowed, would end up in the same similar place or in a similar culture or community, if there was that connection. Yeah.
Do we still accumulate karma during the Bardo trip?
If so, it would be very insignificant. I've not really read anything about that. I'd only be speculating. But
can you kill somebody in the box?
I don't know.
I'm getting on doubt.
Yeah. Well,
okay, that's
should be, but we could have any sort of motivation.
that's the main idea. And when we get enlightened, for instance, during the death process, then we can choose that we are choosing the rebirth.
Hang on. You say we're already enlightened.
No, I have got enlightened during the death process.
At the time of... Well, then you're beyond death and rebirth.
Yes, so we're getting out of samsara.
Correct.
How can I help others in this space?
Because you emanate, you manifest.
You
take on bodily form.
Okay, so
what I'm talking about is what's called uncontrolled rebirth. This process that we were looking at. Meaning we go through this process based on our actions and mental afflictions and ignorance. When we're enlightened, we don't go through that process anymore because we have no longer any ignorance or mental afflictions. That doesn't mean that we can't manifest and appear in the world as an enlightened being.
Okay, so we can choose another rebirth, right?
We wouldn't use the word rebirth because technically the word rebirth implies uncontrolled rebirth. Usually the word they use is emanate or manifest.
Okay,
so we wouldn't say rebirth.
How can I appear? For instance, like a Spanish boy or something?
Sure,
yeah.
That's possible.
Okay.
I mean...
Then I need to have some hope that some Tibetan monk will find me and guide me and teach me.
No, you know you're enlightened.
So from the moment I was born, I know I'm enlightened?
Yeah. You're not a separate being then.
It happens really. There are some people in the world who are walking around.
Yes.
Yes.
Remember again, we're not talking, see what we have to be careful here is that an enlightened being can manifest in many ways simultaneously, you know, manifest as 100 people simultaneously. Does that mean we have 100 individual mind streams? No. No. So it's not like an enlightened person splits their mind into 100. Well, that's something that's very difficult to understand if we're not enlightened. Last question, then we need to move on to the next topic.
Yeah, I think I get the Bodhisattva concept wrong. I thought we are trying to reach enlightenment so we can come back at our own will to help others.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
But are we then an enlightened being like a Buddha? Because in this Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva stage comes first.
Correct.
So already as a Bodhisattva, I can choose where I want to go.
At a certain stage, once we reach path of seeing.
Yeah, number
third.
So then I can choose, like Lama Yeshe did, supposedly, to become Öse. But if somebody has become a Buddha, like complete enlightenment, he's beyond being a Bodhisattva, so he could stay in this enlightened state or it comes back.
Well, he wouldn't. They wouldn't, because they're spontaneously motivated to help others. It's not like we're enlightened and go, oh, I don't think I'll help. I think I'll have a break now for a while. I need a holiday. No.
No.
Okay, let's move on to the fifth topic. So here we're on page 115, and the fifth topic is presentation of the measure of having trained the mind. So, like every practice, it would be good to be able to know if you are doing the practice correctly and you are progressing, or whether you're not really going anywhere in your practice. You need to, from time to time, be able to evaluate whether your practice is going in the right direction, whether you're making progress. And so here there are four slogans that can help us to monitor how we are going in this Lojong practice. You know, are we really progressing, or have we sort of gone astray and not really doing the right sort of practice? To introduce this section, I'll read a little bit from this one here, The Practice of Lojong again, from Tralok Gyapgon, page 147, and he says the following here. We may want to assess our mind training practice from time to time in order to evaluate our progress. The four slogans contained in this point are dedicated to measuring our progress on the path by establishing whether our minds are becoming more other-centered, or whether they are simply mired in more subtle habitual perceptions of the world. We need a balanced approach to this Lojong point, because an obsessive concern over our progress is just another form of fixation, while failing to attend to it at all is equally detrimental. Committing these sayings to memory will make them a self-regulatory aspect of our practice. Each of these slogans is a pithy, succinct, often enigmatic saying that reveals its depth through repeated contemplation. They are known as the four methods of appraising, of appraisal for evaluating our ability to exchange self for others on the Lojong path. So let's have a look at these four statements here and see how they can help us. The first one here, it says, the intent of all teachings converges on a single point. So if we look at the commentary on that, on the bottom of page 115, it says, the scriptures and the treatises were taught for the purpose of overcoming self-grasping. Thus, there is no target other than this for the trio of study, reflection, and meditation to destroy. So here we have the three wisdoms of hearing, contemplation, and meditation. When examined, the selfhood of persons is as non-existent as a horn of a rabbit. So that was the one I mentioned the other day. So horn of a rabbit is often the analogy that is used in the text to show, as an analogy for the fact that this self that we're grasping onto is completely non-existent. Nevertheless, it has made us suffer since beginningless time. Observe and analyze whether all your endeavors of body, speech, and mind are directed towards reinforcing your grasping at the selfhood of persons or bringing its downfall. If they are reinforcing it, you are striving solely out of the eight mundane concerns and for the pursuit of greatness in this life. If this is the case, then even if you are observing ethical discipline with dedication, you have erred with regard to your paternal spiritual lineage. Even if you are training the mind through study, reflection, and meditation, the practice has gone awry. On the other hand, if your endeavors are toppling self-grasping, you are achieving the true purpose of ethical discipline with industry, and you are training the mind with skillfulness. In this way, by giving rise to genuine mind-training realizations in your mind, you can likewise attain the full measure of Dharma practice. Since this is a benchmark for determining whether a Dharma practice has truly become a Dharma practice, the Master said, this is the long bar of the scale of a scale on which the practitioner is weighed. So that, again, learn to turn all your endeavors of body, speech, and mind into antidotes to self-grasping. And, of course, on top of self-grasping, we can add, of course, self-cherishing as well, because that's coming from the self-grasping mind. So here's a few things I want to mention. First is these eight mundane concerns. These are often called the eight worldly concerns. And that is really based on this self-grasping mind. With the self-grasping mind, we tend to believe as if the source of our happiness and suffering is out there. So we try to manipulate the things around us. We try to, of course, attract people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away and avoid people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. So we end up in this, as mentioned in the previous, the third point, we end up in this hope-fear cycle, hoping for pleasant experiences, fearing and worrying about unpleasant experiences. And so this is what the eight worldly concerns is about, is talking about this approach to trying to find happiness and trying to overcome suffering. And there, in these eight worldly concerns, there are four pairs. In each pair, there's one thing we're trying to get, and the other thing is we're trying to push away or avoid. The first pair is gain and loss, meaning that we often feel as if, and gain, of course, is material wealth, material possessions. We often feel that in order for us to be happy, we need more stuff. We need more money. We need more wealth. We need more possessions. We need more material things. The more material things we have, the more happy we're going to be. And the opposite is, we feel is true as well, is that if we don't have these material things or we lose them, we lose our money and wealth, then definitely that's going to be a source for suffering. So we have a lot of attachment to material wealth, and we have a lot of aversion to the opposite. The second pair is pleasure and pain. Also, we tend to equate pleasure with happiness, meaning we often feel that the more pleasure I have, the more happy I will be. So we have a lot of attachment to pleasurable experiences. And of course, we often identify pain with suffering. So of course, we don't want that pain, so we have aversion to it. So again, we have attachment to pleasure and aversion to pain. But not only this, we also often feel that for our happiness, it's we are very concerned about what people say about us. That we often feel for us to be happy, we need people to be saying good things about us or praising us. And of course, we often feel as if when people blame us for things, particularly things we didn't do, then this is definitely the cause of our suffering. So again, we have a lot of attachment to praise, and we have a lot of aversion to blame. But also we feel that for us to be happy, it's not only important what people are saying about us, but also it seems to be important what people are thinking about us. So this fourth pair is good reputation and bad reputation. So also we have a lot of attachment to that, the fact that people are thinking good things about us, that they're thinking we are a good person. And of course we have a lot of aversion to the idea that people are thinking not so good things about us, thinking that maybe we're a bad person. So we have a lot of attachment to the things on the left, a lot of aversion to the things on the right. And this is often our approach in terms of trying to find happiness and overcome suffering. And of course, the Buddhist assertion is that this approach is very problematic. In fact, not only won't we really find our happiness, but the more attachment we have to the things on the left and the more aversion we have to the things on the right, the more unnecessary suffering we're going to induce upon ourselves. Because if we don't get the things on the left, we're going to be very frustrated. Even if we get them, they're not really going to fully satisfy us. We're going to want more, 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 more. And then we'll have a lot of dissatisfaction when the things on the left don't really live up to our expectations and fulfill us in our life. So here then, what it's saying in this section is how to measure if our Lojong practice is working or not, is self-grasping reducing. If self-grasping is reducing, and again with self-grasping comes self-cherishing, then we should notice that our attachment to these things and our aversion to these things should be reducing. So what we're not saying here, of course, is that according to Buddhism, that it's somehow bad or wrong to have a lot of money, to have pleasure, to be praised and have a good reputation. We're not saying this. Whether or not you have these things is not the important point. The important point is our attitude towards these things. If we have the attitude of craving and attachment for the things on the left, and the attitude of aversion to the things on the right, then that is only going to induce a lot of unnecessary suffering on us. So we can have lots of money and not have attachment to it, and maybe use that money to benefit others, as with now Bill Gates. I think he's basically donated all of his money to charity to help particularly research in terms of cancer and these sorts of things. In fact, his organization with his wife, that organization is the biggest charity in the world, and it's bigger than the Nine Next Collective in terms of amount of money they're putting in. I just read the other day, there was an interview with him, and he said the most satisfying thing he's ever done in his life was to give all of his money away. That's the most rewarding thing he's ever done in his life. So again, we can have a lot of money and not have attachment to it and use it for a good purpose, or we can be completely destitute and have a lot of craving and attachment for money. So again, it's not whether or not we have these things, it's the main point is our attitude towards these things. So here it's saying that if our Lojong practice is not really working well, meaning reducing self-cherishing, self-grasping, we're probably going to find more attachment to the things on the left and more aversion to the things on the right. So this is one measure of whether this Lojong practice is working. Are we still caught up in these eight worldly concerns? Is that where all of our energy is going? So this is what is being mentioned here in this first part. So any questions on that before we go to the second? This is the next point. The next point says, of the two witnesses, uphold the principal one. So your answer to your question is coming there. It's coming there. yes, any other questions? Yeah.
See, for example, in office, last year I had missed a promotion. And I left the job and I joined another one. Now, it was because I felt, and my boss also felt, that the business was perfectly fine, but he did not take me to the next level because he thought I was a little soft and was not the type who would hit, and they wanted some cowboy, I don't know what. So, now, if I am doing in that life, and a Buddhist practitioner wants to think on these lines, and I'm being given a feedback that you do not act in a manner which is sort of have a reputation of, you know, being a tough taskmaster, is it bad? Because of course I got a new job and I came to a bigger city and things like that, but then how can I say that I'm not bothered about my reputation, or is this just not a feedback? Because integrating it is where I want you to elaborate on.
So it depends what you mean by a tough taskmaster. If that means to manipulate and cheat and deceive others, then that's not the sort of tough taskmaster we want to be. If tough taskmaster means to be open and clear and honest, and if someone's trying to manipulate us, to really be firm on that, then that's what we want to be. So it depends what you mean by tough taskmaster.
Does that mean that I'm not so worried about my reputation at that point of time, because my reputation was a very soft reputation? But it's not that it affected business, but my reputation was a soft reputation. So when I hear this, should I be saying that why am I worrying?
Well, see, the thing is, no matter how much you try to boost your reputation, you're always going to find people who think of you badly. Even if you're the kindest, wisest, best person in the world, you will always find people who will hate you. I mean, there are a number of people who hate the Dalai Lama and say he's evil. So you will not get to the point where everyone's going to think good of you. So it's going to be futile to try to make everyone think good of you. Yeah. What we need to do is, from our own side, of course, is to have an ethical lifestyle and try to work as best we can. And then I think people who see that will then, in a genuine way, see that we're a very kind, honest person in that way. And then there's going to be people who won't like you and who will think bad about you. So if our goal is to try to get everyone to think good of us, we're not going to ever achieve that, ever. And often what people do, unfortunately, is to try to get people to think good about them is they do things which are not so ethically minded, just so that someone will think good about them. You know, we maybe give them money for some unnecessary reason or so forth. So I think this is not a very good approach. Yeah. So I think from our side, if we really try our best, then, you know, again, we're always going to find people who say bad things about us and so forth, no matter what we do. So if we hinge our happiness on that, we're never going to be happy, because it's always going to be people who slander us and say bad things about us. So then if our happiness is contingent upon this, we're going to be miserable, for sure, no matter what we do. Okay, let's move to the second point now and try and answer this question that was here. So the second way of knowing whether our Lojong practice is working or not is exactly the question that came up, is of the two witnesses, uphold the principal one. And it says here, people might say of you, this brother's heart has become softened. I'm reading much light here. Like a piece of wood that is taken out of water after being washed. Genuine spiritual practice has arisen in him. True Dharma practitioner refers to all who are like him. not being disapproved of by those who are reputedly sublime is a form of witness. So what this is meaning is that if we have some sort of valid level of practitioner in the spiritual path, who can genuinely see where we're at, then this is a form of witness, that they can understand if our practice is going well or not. It says, but this should not be the principal one. Why? Because others may praise you when you observe one or two good actions or when you do a few good things that please them, but other people cannot fully penetrate the depth of your character. What then is the principal witness? Regard it to not becoming the object of your own disapproval. You should be able to feel that even if you were to die this evening, you could have done nothing more. For you have striven to the best of your capacity with faith, intelligence, and perseverance, regardless of how weak these may have been. Another Tibetan expression, such that your guts become filled with air and blood and water gushes out of them. At that point, you have attained a qualified stage of meditative practice. Therefore, hold this fact of not being the object of your own disapproval as the principal witness. So what it's saying is here is that who can see whether or not we are proving in practice. There are two witnesses here. One is other people, and here it talks about particularly other people who are more advanced in the spiritual path and who can really see where we're at. So they are a valid form of witness to see at what stage whether our practice is going well or not. And of course the other witness is ourself, because we can see what's going on in our mind, and of course we can outwardly display that we're doing all the right sorts of things and thereby trick other people, and people think that we're some high-level practitioner when in fact we're not, because we're just making an outward display. Of course, we ourselves know that's what we're doing, so we can see that actually we're not really progressing in the practice. So here it's saying that the principal witness is to monitor ourselves. But then the question here was, we can deceive ourselves. So to sort of answer that a little bit, I'd also like to read from Alan Wallace what he says about this point here, the second point. This is on page 232. He says, who can be trusted to judge the progress of our spiritual practice? We might appear impressively spiritual to other people, but they are not necessarily the best judges of our progress. The mind training says the best judge of our progress is the chief of two witnesses. Who are these two? One witness is other people who observe us from outside, but they are limited by their inability to observe what happens in our minds. This requires the second witness, ourselves. We alone can observe our motivation and the quality of our minds from moment to moment. Of the two witnesses, yourself and others, the chief witness is yourself. Rely on yourself honestly to monitor the quality and progress of your practice. This is not simple because there is no question that we can delude ourselves. So this is why we also consult spiritual friends and teachers. In short, we need to attend to both witnesses, but rely primarily upon the chief witness, ourselves, to monitor and observe the quality and results of our practice. So, does this answer your question? Yeah. So, here again, we need to self-monitor, self-regulate, and to see whether or not we are actually progressing in the practice. But also, what's being mentioned here is that we also can rely on the other witness, other people, particularly here, qualified teacher or a more high-level practitioner. Because they, through their own practice, can really more better see what is going on with us in our practice as well. So we can also rely on our teacher for this purpose. So this is one reason why it's very helpful to have a qualified teacher, because they can probably see us better than ourselves and really help guide us in this path, particularly if we're sort of deceiving ourselves a little bit. They can help uncover that. So this is the second point in terms of knowing whether the practice is progressing or not. Then let's go to the third point, the third measure of whether our practice of Lojong is progressing or not. And that is cultivate constantly the joyful mind alone. This line suggests that having trained your mind and tasted the flavor of true Dharma practice, no matter what adverse circumstances befall you, you experience no disturbance within, for you immediately think, I can cultivate its remedy, the two awakening minds. Remain unassailed in such a manner is also a measure of having trained the mind. So a measure of having of our mind training going well is that when we are faced with these adverse conditions, then instead of instantly seeing them as problem and having aversion to them and having a lot of mental afflictions arising, we can then, when that difficult situation arises, then we can see how we can use that to actually cultivate wisdom and compassion, to improve in the past. So that is a measure of how, if our mind training is working or not. Are we reacting to these difficult situations, or are these difficult situations starting to appear as opportunities for us? Of course, that doesn't mean they're not going to be difficult, but so this, I think, is the guideline here, is that if we see a difficult situation as a problem, then our mind is not usually very joyful because we're going, oh, go away, I don't want this. Whereas if we're seeing this difficult situation as an opportunity, then we will have this more joyful mind. Of course, it's difficult, but we will see that here is a really excellent opportunity to develop in the practice, the wisdom and compassion. The next paragraph says, again, regarding the four desirable things and four undesirable things in the world, those are the eight worldly concerns, the four desirable on the left, for undesirable on the right, when you train the mind by focusing on the four undesirable things, everything becomes desirable. So again, when we are faced with loss, pain, blame, or reputation, how do we respond? Do we react with aversion, hostility, anger, and hatred? Or do we see these situations as something that we can use to improve ourselves in our practice? You will find thus no narrow mountain terrains or impediments. Thus your mind will always be filled with joy and the edifice of your mind training practice will not crumble. This too is a measure of having trained the mind. And then another paragraph, it says, again, when you have trained the mind in the dual practice of giving and taking, then whatever suffering afflicts your body and mind, you will instantly have the thought, now what I have taken from others in the past has its consequence, and you will experience once again an extraordinary sense of joy. So again, here this in summary, in brief, whatever undesirable events occur, if they become factors conducive for training your mind and cause no disquiet, this is a measure of having trained the mind. At that point, your remedy has reached its true depth. So again, here the point is the test of whether our mind training is moving in a good direction is when we are faced with these difficult situations in our life, how do we respond? Are we simply reacting with aversion, hostility, and anger? Or are we seeing these difficult situations as opportunities for developing ourselves, for developing wisdom and compassion? So this is another measure of how well our mind training practice is going. And the fourth point here is very much related to the third point. So let's look at that. It says here, if this can be done even when distracted, you are trained. Meaning that even when you're not really focused and then some adverse condition or difficult situation suddenly arises, if at that point we can really respond in the same way, that's a measure of having been well trained. Of course, now, if we are very focused and some difficult situation arises, it may be easier to then try to look at that difficult situation as an opportunity. But here it's saying that another measure is even when we're not really that focused and we're a little bit distracted and then suddenly something comes up, a difficult thing, how do we respond? And so here the commentary says, just as a skilled horseman does not fall when distracted by the horse suddenly rearing up, in the same way, once your mind is trained, then even when unexpected adversities arise, such as unanticipated criticism and denigration, you instantly cope by applying appropriate antidotes. In this way, if adversities become factors conducive to the awakening mind, and if you do not fall prey to the adverse conditions, your mind is trained. So again, I think that's very much related to the third point, also saying that even if we're sort of distracted or something unexpected, I mean, it's one thing to when you're expecting some hardship or adversity to come up to be prepared and then respond in a good way. But here it's saying even if something unexpected arises, how do we respond? If we really can, in those, when things unexpectedly arise, unexpected criticism, for example, then how do we handle that situation? Are we reacting still, or are we seeing that as an opportunity to practice patience and compassion and also the wisdom factor? And then here at the bottom we have the summarizing paragraph. It says, furthermore, cultivate the thought. The time of death is uncertain, and were it to come suddenly, I have no means of facing it other than this practice. This is true Dharma. Wonderful indeed is my path. In this manner, make sure you fortify the mind so that no matter when you die, you will do so joyfully with a palpable warmth within. If you possess these signs of being trained, illness and harms caused by possessors will enhance your realization. This doesn't mean that you need not train your mind further. This merely presents the measure of when the application of the remedy attains the measure of completeness. So again, these are the four statements that can help us understand if our mind training is moving in a good direction. Again, the first one was, is our self-grasping, self-cherishing mind reducing or not? Or are we getting more caught up in the eight worldly concerns? Then to monitor, we can rely on ourselves, honestly, but also we can rely on others, particularly qualified teachers and spiritual practitioners, to monitor that. And then how are we responding when difficult situations arise? Are we reacting still, or do we have a more joyful state of mind, seeing these difficult situations as opportunities to further develop our wisdom and compassion? So this is really the how to measure if our mind training practice is going well. So that is the fifth point, and that's where I'd like to leave it this morning. Any questions on that before we finish up for lunch?
I have a general question which does not fit so well on this, but you know, what is the idea, where does it lead to? It's all received, you know, all the aim is reached.
Well, sorry, I didn't understand. Where does what lead? This practice.
Then the whole world is blank.
Blank?
Yeah, blank because it's empty of inherent system.
No, no.
Instead of clear-like mind.
Blank is
no,
not.
No, and maybe it's the wrong word. But, you know, it's the state of realizing the emptiness.
Sure.
The state of realizing emptiness.
Right.
Then there's, you know, there's billions of streams of consciousness.
Yes.
Still continue.
Sure.
And rest in a state of clear light mind.
Right.
And,
which manifests as infinite compassion and loving kindness for everyone.
But there is no one where you have compassion to?
Well, the text says we don't need to speculate about that because there are many people suffering now.
Yeah, but you know, this is the aim. You know, it's aiming at this end.
Sure. Then we all live in perfect happiness forever.
Something which, you know, an enlightened person or an enlightened mind or whatever has, you know, as a vision, is it something which, you know, is the at the end of all those kind of development, there is this kind of state that, you know, every mind is in a state of mind.
Yes.
Yeah, is this then the vision? You know,
it's
possible?
Is it yes, the goal is to everyone to achieve enlightenment, to be in the clear light state of mind, to have genuine happiness forever. That's the goal. Well, if it wasn't possible, then people wouldn't be attempting it. But again, to have clinging and an attachment to that goal is counterproductive now. Write about it all the time in the Mahayana.
No, all the way, but not...
Exactly.
But this is reached one day.
We don't need to worry about that now. That's the whole point.
I don't worry about it.
Good.
You know, think about what you know...
Yeah, but again...
Sometimes it's reached, and then there's a state of streams of consciousness, all, you know, the imprint,
genuine happiness.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the goal. And to speculate about that and think about, well, what does that mean and so forth, now has no purpose and is counterproductive.
Yeah,
it's just a thought. And so the thought is, I want to achieve enlightenment so I can liberate everyone from samsara and bring everyone to enlightenment. With that aspiration, we work in the present moment to do that, implement that. That's it. To continue to speculate about what the future might look like is not going to, it's going to block us.
Yeah.
Well, then we understand that's the goal, and then we work in the present moment towards that goal. That's all we do. Yeah. Then we all have a holiday, yes. Last question, then we'll break for lunch.
It says, now what I've taken from others in the past has its consequences.
Yeah. So this is to let go of aversion to any difficult suffering situation we have. Yeah. So by understanding in this way, then we can see our own suffering, difficult situation, and use that to develop wisdom and compassion, to stop having aversion to that. That's what it's indicating, I think, in that sentence.